Hi, I'm Pini Resnick.
And I'm Jamie Dobson, and I'm also happy to be here today on the Agile Uprising podcast. Greetings, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host again. You're stuck with me again, Jay Hursko. And the topic of this episode is one I've been waiting to get to for quite a while. Luckily, the stars aligned and I was able to get these folks on the phone. We're going to be discussing the O'Reilly book, Cloud Native Transformation, Practical Patterns for Innovation. And we are blessed and lucky to have two of the authors of this book on the recording with me. So first, I have Pini Resnick. Pini, thank you for joining.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I also have co-author Jamie Dobson. Jamie, thank you to Zuyu as well.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Thank you. I can't express, and I was showing pictures of how many flags I got to put some in the show notes, flags and notes and stuff I've actually taken in this book. I would love to fire it via bazooka at people and just tell them to read it. But before we go into generously praising the book, let's start with, guys, why a book? Why now? Why this topic? Where did that come from?
I think the general idea of the book is... And why now? It's because we're running a company that actually helps other businesses to move to cloud native. And there's a lot of misunderstanding what cloud native is. And one of our biggest challenges is to actually tell people that, you know, cloud native is not just technologies. It's not just a bunch of tools, but it's a lot more. It's more cultural change. And after telling this story so many times to customers or potential customers and friends and others, it's just, we had enough content to actually write a book about it.
And of course, the thing about patterns is they bridge the so-called experts, which in this case is us, with the, well, I wouldn't say laymen or laywomen per se, but people who have not been exposed to cloud native transformation. And the idea is that patterns, exactly like Christopher Alexander's original design patterns, help people to understand the context in which they're working.
And I personally like the approach of a pattern versus the trite and true framework, right? Because with a pattern, you're really saying, here's the synopsis, and we'll get into this in a minute. You know, here's what it is, here's what you want to do, here's what you want to look out for. Whereas a framework, it automatically puts people into that predefined mental model of, okay, if I follow all these steps, I'll be successful. Completely regardless of the current environment, the culture, what have you. And then we know that's where things go. That's where things start to get goofy. So I just want to give an intro with my exposure with the book. I saw this book pop up on Amazon. And again, I've never written code. So I'm one of the listeners is wonderful hearing this. I've never written a line of code in my life. So I'm looking at cloud native transformations. I'm going, oh shit, is this going to be over my head? And then I saw it was 500 pages and I'm like, and it's an O'Reilly book, right? So you know, it's going to be in the weeds. And I'm going, oh man, I hope I don't buy this thing. And I just stare at it and go, I need help trying to understand it. Like, shout out to Mark Burgess and his promise theory stuff. I actually enlisted help to get through those books. But I bought this book and I picked it up and I started reading it on a Saturday. And I think I spent an entire weekend outside just reading and highlighting and blasting through it. Right. I think there's a lot to be gained here, even for, to steal what Jamie's, it's not necessarily the layman, laywoman, layperson, but if you're anywhere involved in technology, in the enterprise, or even in a small company, this is where the world is going. It makes sense to, let's get on the train, right? One of the first quotes that jumped out at me, it was a back-to-back of when you started defining what cloud native actually means. You know, we started, before we were recording, we were talking about the idea of a cloud. People think of this, of it as like this amorphous, you know, fake entity up in the sky where we just throw code up there and it just miraculously works. There's two quotes in here that I picked out that I thought were really insightful. The first one was, it's not about the servers, but the services. And that dovetailed right into, it's about how we create and deliver, not where. And I think that's a very, very big statement that people need to be aware of, right? It just, you know, these practices, these patterns that you suggest, you don't have to do it in AWS. Some of these are just common sense, right?
Pini, you've got to take this one. This was yours. servers but, and services, not how but where. This is yours. You've got to take this one. I'm going to take the one on strategy and options.
Okay. of course, it's not about technology. And that's the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge for people is to think that they think that they just buy a tool, Kubernetes or something. They can just hire somebody to install it and then they're good to go. But in reality, it's not the same speed of change. The world is changing much faster. The innovation is going now, not every 10, 20, 30 years. A dramatic disruptive change is happening now every 2, 3, 4 years. What it means is that if you dedicate 2 years to change from old way of doing things into new way of doing things, then you will always be in the process of change. So you need to integrate the change as part of your normal work. And for that, it's not about specific cloud. Like in the first 2 years, we met people who moved to Mesos, for example, and then 3 years later, they were moving to Kubernetes. And they're still hiring external people to help them, which makes no sense, right? What people need to learn is how to do the change itself. Doesn't matter what it is. And the patterns are all about actually helping people to figure out the process of change rather than adoption of a specific tool.
And to follow on from what Pini said there, Mesos, Kubernetes, these are accidental properties of cloud native. They're not wholly relevant. So at the heart of this is a culture. It's a way of being. Abraham Maslow, the psychologist, used to talk about this. So you can put an all-black rugby union kit on anybody in the street. That doesn't make them a professional rugby player. And you can give any company in the world Kubernetes, AWS, and Elastic on demand. It will not make them cloud native. It will not magically make them experimental, which is at the absolute heart of cloud native. And so Pini's right. These technologies are really, not only are they not part of the story, they're a distraction.
And you both touched on the culture piece of it, right? Which we'll get to in a minute, where a lot of times you have these large companies grasping to retain their relevance, their market share, and they see the bright and shiny Kubernetes monster. Oh, let's use Kubernetes, like you said, at AWS and A3. And then they start doing things and then it doesn't work. And they're like, oh, well, this is just a fad. We're going to go away from it, where it's completely... Yeah, you missed the forest for the trees. You completely missed the forest for the trees. Speaking of forest for the trees, again, as a non-developer, as someone who's only written HTML code probably close to a decade ago, the diagram that you laid out on page 9 for me, I have literally copied this and sent this to almost every intern I work with at my current job. And I said, you want to understand cloud architecture? Here it is. In a nutshell, right? And Dave Snowden talks all about the four quadrant diagram and how that's, as humans, that's how we remember things because it's just easiest. You know, you have infrastructure and platforms as a service. You have containerization. There's automation, orchestration, and sitting right in the middle is microservices. I feel like a fanboy. I'm probably embarrassing myself, but I can't say this enough, how much I've sent this to people and say, look, you know, what is cloud? Well, here's what it is in a nutshell. Where did this kind of idea come from? Were you just kind of knocking stuff around and say, well, at its almost kernel, at its genetic code, this is what it comes down to? How did that come about?
Actually, the source of this diagram, or the origin of this diagram, coming from CNCF, the Cloud Native Compute Foundation, and their definition of cloud native, which is actually can be summarized as containers, orchestration, and microservices. Right. We're expanding it to also a public cloud or IS-PaaS, and of course automation, because that's missing. Later on, we also expanded to more cultural and other aspects of the story. But on the technical level, this is actually, there is quite strong agreement in industry that this is what you actually need as tool set. And orchestration, of course, currently is led by Kubernetes. That's the tool that is doing where it is doing. But the thing is that if you do orchestration and containers, but you don't use microservices, you are missing out, right? Mm-hmm. This holistic approach to actually doing all of those elements is as important as each of the elements.
I think the original definition from the Cloud Native Compute Foundation was so good. I think I can almost recite it from memory. And it was something along the lines of a cloud native architecture is microservice orientated, or was it something like microservice and container orientated to make the most out of public cloud infrastructure? And I think people get confused. They think stuff's on a cloud And therefore, it's cloud native. That's not what this is about. The orchestration and the containerization element is about packing virtual machines to keep your costs low on the public cloud. Mm. Automation lets you redeploy your application, make changes and redeploy it quickly so that your system grows at the same pace as your users' needs. This is why Netflix currently has a brand new feature that says, pick me a movie at random. This has arisen out of COVID. People don't know what to decide. So they add a new feature, they deploy it quickly, and voila, there's a change for real users over here in Greenwich, London, where I live. So there are many, many good practices, and automation pops up in all different places, and of course, so does orchestration. But these five ideas together let you build and evolve digital products to run at large scale on top of public cloud infrastructure. As far as architecture is concerned, I think we think that's the end of the discussion. And it's a shame that the CNCF changed the definition.
Yeah. And I would agree. Like, and for my layman, right, I would agree that I've had a couple conversations with people where I broke it down to this point, and they kind of went, Jay, are you sure you're not writing code on the back end? I'm like, no, man, I don't go anywhere near that. I'm just a glorified podcast host. But I love how the simplicity, almost elegance, right, of how it's laid out. And you know, we keep going back to the elephant in the room, right? And the elephant is culture, right? There's a quote here. If you simply layer the latest tech, page 15, if you simply layer the latest tech on top of the same old way you've always done things, you're going to create a whole new slew of problems. And I think that is an explicit acknowledgement that, you know, we talked about earlier, how leaders need to make. Like, if I'm just going to spackle this, spread like peanut butter, right? We're going to go to the cloud on top of our current existing sand that we're built on, things don't go well. In my life, I have seen in my corporate roles, I've seen a lot of organizations try to do a transformation where they just want to layer safe on top of everything and not acknowledge the cultural and the leadership and the incentivization changes, the people changes that need to be done to match. And when you have that, it's completely incongruous. The pieces don't fit. It's like a bad IKEA instruction set. And then the bookcase falls apart. Right, if I'm going to really, really mix metaphors. One of the things that you talk about early in the book that I thought was really fascinating is, and you come back to it a couple of times, why cloud native, why cloud transformations go wrong. And I actually had an experience in a previous job where when you gave the example of you're going to try and do it once, you're going to try and do it in a small part of your org, it's going to work, you're going to say this is great, you're going to try and blow it up and it's going to fail. And then you're going to bring in a different vendor and you're going to try and blow it up again. And then it's going to fail again. And I'm reading this book and I'm literally like staring off into space. Like,
I mean,
somebody's in my head.
imagine bringing what you've just described is something like this. Imagine bringing a tradesman to your house to give you a new kitchen and it doesn't work. Your family doesn't become instantly happy. The food coming out of the kitchen is no better. So you bring the third tradesman and the fourth tradesman. And in the space of half a decade, you have five kitchens, when really what you needed to do was take marriage counseling. this is how crazy what you're talking about is. Bringing in a set of technologies and installing something in the corner of your house, like a new kitchen and a microwave, and hoping that will change your family dynamic is absolutely insane.
Right, right.
Ultimately, but who's driving that? Who's driving that? People who sell tools, or in my example, people who sell kitchens.
Right. KitchenAid. Yeah.
but it's also we cannot ignore the fact that everyone, like who is currently senior management, meets the senior management in large enterprises. People our age, right, 40s, 50s, 60s, they were studying 20, 30 years ago, right? The way they studied was prepare a really good plan, execute. By the end of it, you have an amazing kitchen, right? I just cannot afford that anymore. It's just not happening. You need to go quickly through that. And these tools, like when you say, I need 2 years plan to lay out the Kubernetes setup, this makes no sense in today's world.
Right, right. I mean, the technology, not even just technology, right? Let's take it a step further. Life moves so fast now. We are all globally interconnected. You know, before we started recording, we were discussing American geopolitics. Right? We are globally connected. You know, 40, 50 years ago, you might've gotten a story about some riots in the States, but you might've gotten it a week later and it might've been of questionable veracity, right? Life is moving too fast now. So to your point, Penny, we can't afford the old way of scientific management. I build this plan, it takes 48 months and we have to just bury our head in the sand and go.
There is a paradox, of course, in here. The needs of people are changing. So 2001 or 2000, you know, 20, whew, how many years ago is that? 21 years ago. By the way, did you realize it's the 21st day of the 21st year of the 21st century?
Yeah, it's kind of nuts. Kind of nuts.
Well, in those 21 years, when Pinny and I both started work, we were happy to have a salary and actually couldn't believe we were being paid to program computers, which is what we did for fun. But nevertheless, the idea of getting extra coaching, unlimited book budgets, and actually enjoying ourselves at work, even 20 years ago, was absolutely unheard of. But the needs and the expectations of young professionals have changed. We now want psychologically safe workplaces. We want to innovate. And on the other side of the coin, the needs of users have changed. All of those young people who were brought up with Amazon and Netflix and WhatsApp, they expect their bank and their city council to provide them the same level of service that they get from these amazing digital products. Mm-hmm. And herein lies a very interesting problem. The people who build those products are all psychologically hugely mature, very creative and hardworking. And if banks and the post office and the local council is to match Netflix and Google, they've got to have an equally innovative workforce. So we choose the tools because we think they're easy, but actually these products, this way of working and way of being, is really a whole system of innovation. And how do you scale that globally?
Right.
Maybe that's what the book's about.
And to add to that, I have teenage kids, right? And they study in school. They have all these new tools, cloud tools, computers. They all use computers. They have to use computer in the school. But the studies are the same. Right? It's still boring. It's still class setting. There's still one teacher speaks to 30 kids or whatever number of kids in the class. And it's the same content when I was studying. On the other hand, my son is playing on Sony PlayStation, right? And it's amazing how attractive it is for them. So how much budget, how much investment goes into education, and still how little it became interesting, right? And exciting, and how little it attracts the kids and encourages them to study, right? And this is the type of lack of innovation that is everywhere in enterprise world. And on the other hand, these new banks like Starling Bank or all kind of these innovative companies, they are providing this exciting new changes all the time, every day.
And to Jamie's point, right? Like I look at my bank and then I look at the example you actually have in the book about the bank that doesn't even have a brick and mortar, right? Because if you think about it, what does my bank do for me? I deposit my check, I pay my bills, I go shopping. It's all via debit, very little via cash. I don't need a brick and mortar. Right. So and the response time is there. The web UI is navigable. It's friendly. It's something I can use. There's all sorts of stuff about the generational divide, the technology divide. I mean, there's an old joke that science advances one dead body at a time. So if Jamie has spent his whole life saying the Earth is the center of the universe, right? And he is in a position where that he's made his thesis and his entire career out of it, right? He's not going to change his mind. And part of that is a human thing, but it's also, that's what he's made his bones with. And then when Jamie dies and Penny's sitting behind him going, this guy was crazy, right? The sun is the center of the earth. At this point, those gatekeeping, right? That gatekeeper is gone and it's open for new ideas. And I think part of the things you talk about in the book with culture, right, is you need to question that old mindset, that old gatekeeping mentality of, well, this is the way we've always done things. We need to be open-minded.
That has to change. I think this is the biggest problem that we are describing in the book, is that this generational change, you have to change the generation to bring the change, is impossible to maintain anymore because the change needs to be every 3 years. You cannot wait until the manager retires. You have to change now.
What you're talking about is the so-called nemesis effect. So apparently, I'm not sure how old everybody is on the podcast right now, but when I was a kid, we were taught that dinosaurs all died because of a meteorite. Now, only 20 years earlier, that theory was discredited and not held in mainstream. Now, what was the change that happened in the 20 years before my birth that changed popular belief? Well, the old scientists who pioneered the earlier belief, they all died. This is the nemesis effect. And this was how a shift in belief happened. But I honestly don't think that will change things in cloud native. So I've been working on a new, I don't know if you know, but we've got a new initiative at Container Solutions. It's called WTF Cloud Native. What the fuck is Cloud Native? Now, considering we wrote a book about this, you think we might have the answer. Now, part of the answer, well, we don't have the answer, by the way. You've got to subscribe to find out. But even then, you won't find out. Now, so I was studying Andy Grove. He was the he was the COO of Intel. He was the first employee there, actually, after the two founders. He was born in Budapest. So he was an immigrant to the United States. He had first avoided the death camps from Hitler, and then he avoided Stalinist Hungary when they took over thereafter. And he was one of a couple of 100,000 people who had escaped, young people who had escaped Hungary and arrived eventually in Silicon Valley. This type of formative experience creates leaders. So exactly what Pini said earlier, his son has been taught the same old stuff that we were taught. Entrepreneurs and leaders are forged in the fires of extremely difficult circumstances. And the problem is, if we have got a very run-of-the-mill education system, where is the next Grove coming from? And where is the next Hastings coming from, the CEO and other founder of Netflix? Mm-hmm. This is an issue. Now, we're pretty entrepreneurial. We've also not had the most straightforward journeys in our life so far. But how do you take something that's bequeathed by trauma, essentially leadership, and then scale that? Because ultimately, leadership and cloud native go together. And leadership qualities and behavior is actually very few and far between.
And I think to your point, Jamie, building on that point of, you know, forged in the fires of adversity, right? If you look at some of our most successful CEOs, some people who have come up with new ideas, right? If you look at Steve Jobs and you look at his resume, whether you love him or hate him, right? You know, the jury's still out, right? But if you look at his life experience leading up to what he did at Apple, he took a calligraphy class, which influenced how he viewed the design of the phones. He was a failed, you know, startup guy. So he kind of learned how to structure a business, right? He had all these different varied experiences, which lead to a, not only a more, I would argue, more fruitful life, but you come away with a different appreciation and assessment, a different way of looking at things. And a lot of the stuff you talk about in the book is, it really is truly just a new way of looking at things. And I love how you brought up the nemesis effect, right? Because for our listeners, there's a giant chunk of the book which talks about actual behavior, biases, nudges, which I actually refer to this book when I'm not even doing work stuff, when I'm trying to do other things, because I'm like, I know I saw that bias somewhere. And I use your Cloud Native book as a reference on unconscious and conscious bias. So, budding psychology minors out there, you pick this book up. It's a great cheat sheet. But I thought that was an interesting but very well-deserved inclusion because, like you said, Benny, you know, we have – it's a new generation of people who are used to a different way of working, and we need to be cognizant of some of the roadblocks we're going to run into with dealing with people who may not be aware of the whole idea of unconscious bias, may not be aware of, you know, the whole ad hominem attack where I come into you with a new idea and you just yell at me about budget, right? That's a whole different piece that we, as humans, as just good humans, we need to be cognizant of.
So as a consultant, you learn that all the problems are human problems. You rarely deal with technology problems because they're easy to solve. And the human problems are not when people know what needs to be done. And, you know, it's difficult to find a problem that people are not aware of entirely, right? So it's like you come to a person and say, you need to move to cloud. They say, yeah, of course, I know it. And I know it for 5 years now. And I'm still not there. How do you help me actually do it? And that is related to the biases, to all kind of status quo biases and and confirmation biases and all kind of biases that just block people from taking the actions and seeing the world the way it actually is, not the way they want it to be. And instead they continue planning, they continue investing in tools, they continue doing other things because that's what they have been doing in the past.
Right.
And you see through the lens of bias, cloud native transformation is connected to those who can keep on top of the bias, which is another word for emotionally and psychologically mature people. Mm-hmm. There is a link. I can tell you something funny about biases as well. Since we wrote a book on it, you could say we're somewhat experts, but this doesn't stop us falling prey to biases either, including negative attribution bias. So this is interesting when working together with Prini, where you're as liable to fall into biases as even if you know about them. Maybe there's a bias. Is there a bias for that, Prini?
I think there is. I vaguely remember there is one. Yeah.
There's bias for everything. It's, every human behavior is. And the good thing with bias is that most of the time, they're actually good behaviors that are beneficial for us. That's why they exist. But there are these sort of circumstances that they, you need to recognize that that's where we are really susceptible to doing something wrong. Yeah. And it's very difficult to see yourself from outside, right? So you have to have an advice, external advice, to sort of absorb you and point those biases out when you're behaving in the wrong way.
Go on, Jamie.
I was going to say some of our more recent research points to, we call it the Norman Dixon paradox. So this was a guy, Norman Dixon was a psychologist, and he wrote a book in 1976. And basically he said this, the type of person who's attracted to the military is somebody who likes order and regimentation, which is exactly the wrong type of person to fight on the battlefield. So the military naturally attracts people who would be no good at the military's ultimate aim, which is to win battles. It's the same with enterprises. They attract ordered people, people who don't like chaos. And yet this is exactly what cloud native is. It's a type of organized chaos. But there's something worse, or there's something more to add to that. Normal people, so people who are not necessarily ordered, just sort of middle of the road people, not too chaotic, not too ordered, when placed under stress, they become more ordered and they seek safety. So if you're a company with an existential threat because of your competitors or because Amazon's decided to play in your backyard, the last thing you, and cloud native is the thing that can help you escape from that and help you compete, all of a sudden the stress causes you to be more ordered and more anal, if you were, than normal, which of course destroys your reaction, kills your creative thinking.
It ends up being a self-defeating prophecy where you kind of just recursively spiral downwards, right? You look for more, so you apply more. It's the same thing where you have a project that's run in a traditional manner that gets a little bit loose, right? It gets a little bit out of control. So you put more process controls in place to prevent that from happening. And then by adding more overhead and more process controls, you tightly constrain the system. So things get even worse, and then you add more constraints, it gets worse, you add more constraints, and then you eventually end up with the equivalency of a corporate policy where you can't order anything more than a stack of Post-its without getting approval from 17 people in hardware, software, desktop support.
Right, and to an external person, it appears to be stupid and self-defeating, but it's actually the psychological effects of stress.
And all this effects are very well described in the book Mythical Man Month by Fred Brooks in 70s. All of those questions are already answered. There's things like adding people to late project makes it later.
Yep.
9 women cannot make a child in a month, right? And all kind of other things, right? It's just there are limitations of human behavior, and you cannot, if you put more pressure, you don't automatically get better results. If you had more people, you don't automatically get better results.
Right, right. Too much pressure does not automatically turn the coal into a diamond. You may just get a highly compacted, fragmented piece of coal.
Right. And the innovation has to have a certain level of chaos, right? There is a saying in one of the book I read recently, innovation lives on the edge of chaos. Because if you create too much structure, there is no innovation in such environment. On the other hand, if there is no structure at all, if there's total chaos, there are no practical deliverables, there is no value delivered, there is just creativity, which is art. And art is great, but it's not practical.
Go on, Jamie.
I was gonna say, since innovation lives on the edge of chaos, that's where innovative teams have to live. And if you're there all the time, you end up looking like me. Tired, bags under your eyes.
Yeah, but I would say that's a good problem to have. But to the point about innovation happening at the chaos, right? And chaos, we know that innovation always happens at the edges, right? It's never centrally driven. And I think part of the, you know, back to human bias and psychology and whatnot, you know, people want to boil things down to a false dichotomy and then pick A or B, right? And this is our mammal brain sitting on top of our lizard brain. If you ever read any of that stuff about the triune brain theory, it's all about calorie saving, right? I need to hunt the next mammoth. I want to make decisions with the minimum amount of calorie expansion possible. So I'm going to boil it down to an A or a B. I'm going to pick A and I'm going to go. Whereas you need that chaos, you need that complexity on the margins to let things breathe, right? To let things go. And to take it back to the book, that's one of the things that I was really, you know, my bazillion flags here sticking out the side. A lot of the patterns that really resonated with me was, it's not just for cloud native. It's not just for standing up a cloud infrastructure. These are things that as an enterprise, you should really be thinking about. And like an example, the idea of gradually raising stakes, right? That's something where, okay, well, I would question most leadership teams on some of our enterprise listeners, staffs. Have they ever thought about that idea? Can we gradually increase the stakes to a point where, okay, let's find the threshold and see how comfortable we can get with this chaos to drive the innovation that we actually need.
So, Pini, do you want me to take that one?
Sure, yeah.
So gradually raising the stakes. So it's very nice of you to say this book is more generally applicable. The book is really, and Pini can correct me if I'm wrong, it's 95% other stuff, and then reordered and repackaged and with a new label stuck on the front. So obviously build automation and containers, these are as old as computing is. And well, at least not containers, of course, Alexa containers came somewhat later, but they're old concepts. Virtual machine is an old concept. But when you repackage it all up, you get this beautiful thing called cloud native. Gradually raising the stakes and big bets and hedges and options is really classic strategy formulation and classic strategic execution. And there's a famous McKinsey paper that cover this. But then to my absolute shock, 2 years ago, I found the same framework in a high school strategy textbook. and so what we're doing, what you should always be doing if you're doing something new is testing things out, first in the imagination. This costs you no money whatsoever. Why would you spend $5 million and 2 years on something you could fix at a whiteboard with a cup of tea? Now, this is the core of our consulting advice. You don't, experience is a good teacher, but she's an expensive teacher. Mm-hmm. Your imagination will get you quite far. Now, from your imagination comes a set of experiments, or at least a set of potential experiments, some of which can be tested in real life. These are basically how you raise the stakes. You try something, and then you build a path back, and then you try again. Now, again, I didn't mean to change this into a psychology podcast, but when you work in an organization that's not psychologically safe, you do one of two things. You take no risks because it doesn't invite criticism, mm-hmm. or you take such huge risks, nobody could ever fault you because you were so ambitious and you had a grand vision. So people deliberately avoid experimentation because within there is accountability. Why did you spend that? What's the next step? Whereas if you go big and say, we're going to move all of our legacy workloads to Amazon in the next 6 months, nobody would criticize you. You'd probably get a pay rise for your ambition. Now, at Container Solutions, you'd get properly in trouble for being stupid. so this is what gradually raising the stakes is about. And as I said, the type of workplaces attract a certain type of people that are either fully risk averse or completely reckless. And the space in between is where you succeed. And that space is pretty much unknown to a lot of companies out there.
Agreed. And to your point, Jamie, there does need to be, you know, I've run into a whole ton of agile coaches, consultants, right? Transformation gurus. We're going to change your org. We're going to change your culture, right? There is almost a lack of acknowledgement that there are. And I think Yuval Harari talked about this when I just finished reading Sapiens. And he talks about that where, you know, with bureaucracy and, you know, here, you know, God, the king is dead, long live the king. Some people just want to be told what to do. And that needs to be a tacit acknowledgement, right? You need to understand that there is going to be a population inside your organization. You're trying to do this whiz bang change, right? You're trying to shift that needle. There are going to be people who will just naturally resist, right? You talked about the people who like to follow command and order, right? Command and control and spiral dynamics, the blues, right? Some people do like to do that, and that's not necessarily bad, but their continued existence in the organization may be incongruent to the greater goals.
There's no problem.
Go ahead, Pini.
Yeah, there's no problem with that. Of course, right. You cannot put a person who is risk averse to take risks, right? That's like, I mean, it's against their nature. You need to put the right people in the right places. Majority of people are expecting to be told what to do, right? And you cannot change that. You need to understand the nature of people, and you need to understand the people you are working with. As a manager, you learn that there is no single management strategy that works on everyone. It's about figuring out on personal level who can do what most effectively. The real question is how you embed the right behavior in the enterprise culture, in the company culture. Mm-hmm. So what is company culture? And what we're saying in the book is basically culture is some of all your behaviors, right? Instead of it's in my DNA that you cannot change, but it's more like, you know, it's just a bunch of small behaviors. If you're talking to somebody and you're saying something wrong, will they blame you for that? Will they, you know, shame you in front of others? Because if they do, then you won't do it next time. Right.
Right.
If you encourage taking risks, if you incentivize people for taking risks, then people will do it. So it's the real question is how you embed the correct behavior in your day-to-day work.
Right, right, right. And that ties to and there are a bazillion patterns in this book. I could have you guys on for hours and we could just go through each one. I'm sure we'd have a blast, especially once happy hour tips over and we start drinking beers, it'll get loose. But this ties directly to one of the patterns that I actually printed out and stuck up on my wall. The idea of managing for creativity, right? The idea of that funnel, right? Of what you, I hate the fact that I quote Donald Rumsfeld, the whole known known versus known unknown versus unknown unknown, right? And funneling that type of behavior and that type of activity into something that's more defined, process oriented, and real. I mean, I saw this and the first thing you think of, well, you think of the triple horizon model, right? I also thought about Jeffrey Moore's zone to win, where when you things move from different zones, you know, it becomes almost a utility. Right. Like the internet is now basically a utility, whether our government will acknowledge that it's a different story. But Jamie, you're going to say something?
I'll just pick up.
Okay.
I think the Three Horizons model is essential for this. And this is an absolutely critical tool for success of for anything. Right. And we are applying this and those patterns, not just in cloud native world, but also, for example, in our marketing team. Mm-hmm. The Three Horizons is about really. It's sort of different angle on raising the stakes, gradually raising the stakes. It's very important that you are, you know, the horizon one is your current business and horizon two is innovation. And horizon two is long-term research. If you didn't do one of them, then you either not making money, right? Or will not make money in the future. One of those, right? And what tends to happen is one way pass, right? We start as a startup, as a small company, you're by nature, you are innovative and you are doing all kind of crazy things because otherwise you have no idea what to do. Mm-hmm. And you become more and more sort of, you get the point. Eventually, until you scale to become an enterprise. And then at that point, everything becomes very algorithmic and consistent. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest drop for enterprises. At that point, they lose the capability to innovate. And that's why what we do for our customers all the time is, for a large enterprise, the most important part is set aside significant portion of time for horizon two and three.
Right.
And those things need to be managed dramatically different because horizon three, which is innovation, is research and creativity. You cannot tell people, you know, I want three innovations by next month. I mean, it just doesn't work this
way. Right, it doesn't work that way. Right, right.
No. So that's an essential element of innovation is to set aside time for the team and manage that time in very, very open way without pressure, set the goals, get the general idea and let people be. And enterprise just cannot do that because
You bring up a good point, Penny, when you say that these different horizons need to be managed in different ways. It's not the one-size-fits-all approach. And that ties to, I just had a conversation with Jonathan Rasmussen from his book. You know, he did a lot of time at Spotify, and his last book was Competing with Unicorns. And he makes the same remark where he said, if you remember, every enterprise was a startup at one point. Everybody was an innovator at any successful org. Was an innovator and startup at one point. And a lot of what you talk about in this book and a lot of what a lot of people are starting to acknowledge now in the greater IT agile space is we need to rediscover that. Like we talk about rediscovering your inner child. We need to rediscover our inner startup and lean on that to innovate us towards success.
And the most successful companies like Google, for example, they do it systematically. They embed it in their way of working. The 20% rule, the internal startups, separate budgets. If you have an idea, they will let you explore. Even if you have an extremely important job to do, they will still take you off. And you put, because, you know, eventually you invent Gmail, right? Or something else that is even bigger than just one person job. And majority of enterprises sort of, they just don't have this capability to innovate. Or in other places, what we see is this 20% ruling. So you have 20% of time to spend on innovation, but it is managed with extreme agile approach where everything is under heavy pressure. Which is actually doesn't allow creativity to thrive.
Right. You need of course, to some, go on, Jamie. Go on.
I was going to say, and of course, some people argue that there is a system for innovation, and it's this: large enterprises squeeze as much profit as they can out of their companies, return that as dividends to shareholders who are private equity firms, who then do startups that the big companies buy back. So some people argue that this system of innovation is the most effective and it's actually working.
I think Jamie's inner cynic is coming out. I definitely need to fly to the UK and have a couple beers with him and see what comes out of it. We're either going to start the next Guy Fawkes revolt, or we're just going to end up having a really great time and a great conversation. But you're right, though. It is cannibalistic in nature, but not cannibalistic in a way that's positive, that enables growth. It's kind of backwards and almost backdoor self-serving, right? Self-dealing.
Well, I mean, you call me a cynic, and I don't mind. I've been called worse things than that. But if you give an accountant, you give the numbers to my colleague Christian and my friend in the accounts department, and he will do your calculation on return on invested capital, and he will mathematically prove it's better to not innovate and buy small companies. And that is what a lot of companies do. Mm. And the problem is, as that model starts to break down, because, for example, Starling Bank here in London, I don't think they're for sale. So they've innovated, nudged their competitors out of the way, but they don't want to be bought. So unfortunately, as that old model breaks down, it does seem that companies seem to, you know, they have to learn how to innovate. Unfortunately, the last 50 years, five decades, business has been about conservation, protecting margins, and having a very narrow focus.
That ties to a lot, we talk a lot about culture and incentive, right? What people are incentivized to do is the way they actually end up doing things, whether they outright acknowledge it or not. I am convinced that one of the greatest travesties pushed on most major companies is the idea of cost accounting as a driver of investment, right? I have completely bought into the idea of throughput accounting. I'm a big fan of the Goldratt Institute and theory of constraints. If somebody out there is listening, please call me. I'd love to have you on the show. I watched a good friend of mine is at a large scale. I'll give you a perfect example. A good friend of mine is at a large scale enterprise company inside the States. I think they got to be around 50 or 60,000 people. So not small potatoes. He jokingly told me the other day, we were connecting over Zoom to have a beer, breaking bread. And he said, I literally watched my company lose an entire quarter of productivity worrying about budgeting for the next year and lining up numbers and lining up whose team got this funding and that funding. And he said, think about all that time we could have actually been doing something that our shareholders, right, to Jamie's point, talk about investors, right, and venture capital, they would love, I'm sure they would prefer us to spend that money innovating as opposed to figuring out, does Jay have enough money to fund Penny and Jamie for the next year? And if not, is he going to borrow it from Carla, or is Carla going to be over as well? You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of, there are some fundamental truths that I think everybody should take a philosophy class and do some soul searching in, and then maybe we can evolve to the right way.
So in a even weirder way, it's like when they decide to invest in innovation, what typically an enterprise would do is they put aside 2 million and 50 people or 5 million or any sub random large number, right? And very large group of people and tell them, go and build a new thing. And those initiatives never work because actually, according to the goal theory and all kind of other theories, right, you just cannot build a successful product from scratch with a large group of people because you need to give them work, right? And in the initial stages of innovation, there is no work for everyone. There's mostly innovation and creativity. And 50 people cannot be equally creative.
No, and it'll work backwards, because every human, most mentally sound human beings, don't want to be a burden and they want to contribute. You throw 50 people together and they'll all want to show that they're creating value and adding worth, when actually they're probably causing headaches.
And especially at large scale, 50 doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a decent amount of people, and you're telling, go be inventive, right? And then things like pecking order from the Howard Bloom's work with the Lucifer principle, pecking order starts coming into play, right? You have natural stratification.
Yeah.
You have people start filling into roles, right? I typically fall into the Joker role. I don't really contribute, but I keep everybody loose and laughing. Probably just overshared and ruined some future career prospects there. But you're right. You can't force creativity and inventiveness in a group by tacit explanation and expectation, and then just expect it to work. It's just not going to work that way.
The other thing we have to talk about values, because if you look at cloud natives who have value prism, it values collaboration and it values experimentation, sometimes for experimentation's sake, which is another way of saying it values playfulness. Some people don't value creativity. Values are what make a politician talk against his best interests or her best interests. Values are what makes a child return a wallet to somebody, even though nobody saw them drop it. You cannot turn up and say to people, we now have to do something creative and collaboratively. As soon as you go up against the value system, you will fight tooth and claw for it. Exactly as we've seen in the United States in the last few years. Mm-hmm. The values of democracy were threatened. And oh my God, did people want to fight back for that? And ultimately, this is the source of a lot of failure with cloud native and with innovation in general. Many people simply don't value what innovation requires. That's not a value judgment. It doesn't mean they're better than us or worse than us. It simply means you'll no more make somebody who doesn't value creative, no matter what you do, no matter what training you give them, or how many, you know, exercises you give them at the whiteboard. It just won't work.
Right. Right. Perfect. And you know what? I think that I couldn't pick a better quote to end on if I tried. So Jamie, thank you for that one. You made my life easier. The end arcs are always a little bit difficult. Again, I've had you guys on for quite a while. I know we could go for quite a while more. If listeners want to find you, they want more information about either the both of you. Obviously we're going to have a link to your website. We'll put a link to the book. We'll have links to all sorts of stuff. If they have questions, they want to reach out, maybe learn a little more. Where do they go?
There are easy ways to find us, which is on Twitter or LinkedIn. But I think the most interesting place to look for is WTF Cloud Native. That's where we're trying to answer all the questions. That's everything we write, create, or discuss is now going under that overall umbrella of storytelling.
Perfect. Jamie, anything to add to that?
No, not at all. So WTF Cloud Native is the best thing to subscribe to. You could always follow both of us on Twitter. I can tell your listeners right now, my Twitter feed includes my hatred of the Conservative government, rugby league, and Cloud Native. And that's it. I exclusively stick to those three things. But at least a third of it's Cloud Native.
It's true. Twitter has become one of those weird places where it really is like
to recall that bit again. Hello.
No. We got you, Jamie. We got you. You never know what you're going to get when you sign into Twitter these days. It's kind of like the most insane digital market. So, first of all, I, on behalf of myself and our listeners, I want to thank you, Jamie. I want to thank you, Penny. I want to thank Carla, your wonderful PR person who helped me set all this up. I want to thank all of you. On behalf of all of us, I want to thank the listeners for tuning in again. If you enjoyed our episode, please give us a review, a rating, leave comments, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. It's on Audible. It's everywhere on your podcast platform of choice. It really does help people find us. If you liked the conversation and you want to hop in more, we have a very, very vibrant Discord server. We had a conversation this morning going on about, I believe it was some sort of cloud technology, and then it dovetailed into The Fifth Element, the movie by Luc Besson back in the 90s, and how amazing Milla Jovovich's acting was. So if you're interested, find us on our Discord server. I'll have links in the show notes. And as always, our shows are free. They will continue to be free. All of our content is free. However, we do have a Patreon. If you really like what you hear and you want to contribute, you will more than likely get a surprise in the mail from me and maybe some funny stickers or whatnot. So once again, on behalf of myself, I want to thank Jamie and Penny. On behalf of Jamie, Penny, and myself, and Carla, I want to thank all of you listeners for tuning in. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast signing out.